From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. As a filmmaker, director Brett Morgan is attracted to real-life subjects with larger-than-life characters. We can start with his film On the Ropes, which dealt with the world of boxing, to a movie that took place inside the mind of Robert Evans, The Kid Stays in the Picture, and his new film is the biggest yet. It's Chicago 10, a mixture of archival footage, recreation, and animation. Brett, first of all, thanks for coming back.
Thanks, Elvis.
You do like taking real-life epic landscapes, don't you?
Yeah, no, I like starting from there and then kind of making it my own. And I think one of the things I'm really interested in is, well, in Bob's case, it was self-mythology, but I'm really into approaching history as myth and sort of liberated from history of facts and dates and letters and whatnot. And with Chicago 10, it was a kind of heavy assignment because this is one of the most written about and covered periods in American history. There's 20 books on the subject, films, documentaries. There was just a wealth of stuff. So we kept saying, well, what can we contribute to this canon of work? And ultimately I said, you know, let's try to do something experiential. Let's, you know, the way Bob Evans' film I used to describe was not so much a film about Bob, but a film that is Bob. And we sort of wanted that with Chicago, except to be the Yippie experience. And
but what you do with it, too, is you also stage it like drama. I mean, yeah. At one point, there's that great quote from Abbie Hoffman. He says, basically, we took this whole thing and made everybody characters in a play. Mm. And to me, that seemed to really be the capsule of what the film is.
That's absolutely right. I mean, that was the subtext that we were working off of, is that this is all a piece of theater. And therefore, the film should be as sublime as the visceral experience that they were trying to create in Chicago.
And would you say this takes place during 1968? Yeah. It's the trial, the aftermath of the Chicago Democratic Convention in 68.
But the protests in Chicago were conceived to be a piece of political theater on a massive scale, probably one of the largest pieces ever staged with a cast of thousands. The Yippies, from the point that they conceived of the protests, knew that all they had to do was show up in Chicago and Daley would go berserk and bring out the National Guard and the troops because they looked different. Daley saw them as, you know, referred to anyone who didn't look like him as a communist. And I think Daley and Judge Hoffman felt it was their duty to responsibility to cut the head off the snake before they polluted the rest of the country. So all these guys had to do, in effect, was show up with their long hair and smile, and out came the tanks and the tear gas. And, you know, in a way, as Abbie says in the film, everyone played their part. You know, the Yippies play their part. The mayor and the city play their part to it perfectly. And you couldn't cast anyone better than Judge Hoffman to preside over that trial.
You couldn't cast anybody better in a weird way than the late Roy Scheider, one of his last parts, doing the voiceover for Judge Hoffman.
That was an incredible experience. And, you know, we don't think of Roy as a sort of guy who does caricature per se. But I needed an actor of that age. And called him up, and he, like all the other actors, just signed on and came on board and I think delivered an amazing performance. Now, what's interesting, Elvis, is a couple critics have commented that some of the performances in the courtroom are you know, one-dimensional, over the top, or what have you. Of course, none of those critics happen to have ever been in the courtroom or ever actually heard Judge Hoffman's voice. During the course of our research, we unearthed actual courtroom audio that no one knew was in existence. Roy does a pitch-perfect impersonation of the judge. I mean, it's uncanny.
The film we're talking about, Chicago 10, director Brett Morgan is here with me. And the great thing about Mayor Richard Daley is just that you kind of forget the kind of outsized sort of Shakespearean evil Falstaff character he was. And you also got that great piece of film from Walter Cronkite saying that Chicago was a police state. I mean, people forget that Chicago, under Mayor Daley, was his own incredibly insidiously evil, corrupt country inside the United States.
It was, and it almost seemed as if Daley single-handedly controlled the army at that week. I don't know what, you know, it's. I was actually asking Tom Hayden the other day about how much he thought Johnson was orchestrating the events, or Hoover for that matter.
Because the rumors are always that it was Hoover who was working in cahoots with Daley in this.
Well, you know, I mean, the Yippies and the mobilization started applying for permits 6 months out in March of 68. And they hired lawyers. They went through the proper channels to do it. And the city from the get-go said no. And at some point, Ramsey Clark, the attorney general, sent a couple guys down to try to negotiate on behalf of the protesters. And Daley refused to accept them into his office. So when everything went down, Ramsey Clark, who was the attorney general at that point, actually wanted to was considering indicting some members of this, you know, the Chicago Authority.
City Council. Yeah, absolutely.
And Nixon wins the election, and the first thing John Mitchell does is file the indictments against the anti-war leaders because he wanted to take them off the streets. Oh, and Bobby Seale, they had to throw him in there because he was really integral to the for those who don't know the story.
Being a little sarcastic, tell exactly how unintegral Bobby Seale was this whole process.
Well, Seale was a last-minute replacement speaker for, I think, Stokely Carmichael, and he basically was like, you know, got a call out of nowhere, never met Abby or Jerry or the Yippies. I think he might have met with Tom or Rennie of those guys, but not about Chicago. They just maybe crossed paths. And so he flew in, gave a speech, and it was somewhat incendiary. It was
somewhat?
All right. It was a hot speech, but nonetheless, in the overall scheme of things that week, it was like a blip on the radar, if you will. And I have footage of it. There were 40 or 50 people standing around. It was not the cause. Put it this way. He didn't make that speech and suddenly everybody listening ran out and started hitting the cops and arming themselves. The entire week were police riots, meaning the police instigated the violence.
But he was a black man and the head of the Black Panthers who was essentially advocating the taking back the streets.
He was actually saying something. What was it about? Shoot the barbecue. We're going to roast them some pork tonight or something. But you know, Dick Gregory. If they wanted to put a black man on that defense table, they should have. You know, Dick Gregory was far more involved in creating a quote unquote riot, if anyone can call
one. But Dick Gregory wasn't actually being followed by the FBI around the country.
No, of course. No, I know why they got Bob. I mean, ultimately. Ultimately, it actually, of course, they wouldn't put Dick Gregory on because Mayor Daley probably thought he was amusing. They put Bobby Seale. They decided to indict Bobby Seale because they wanted to scare the heck out of middle class white America. And so they take all these sort of white liberal middle class college kids, if you will. I mean, they were in their late 20s at the time, but leaders of the anti-war movement, and then Uncle Dave Dellinger. And they throw Bobby Seale on there. And as Jerry Rubin says in the film, he says, you know, the government believes in integration, so we have to have one black guy. So we put the chairman of the Black Panther Party. What could be better than that? Bobby Seale was in Stockholm, Sweden when the indictments came down. He didn't even know – he couldn't even remember he was in Chicago. That was a Jerry Rubin quote. But it was pretty amazing. I mean, it was perfect. It was perfect theater. And you know, it's funny because to me it seems so obvious to conceive of the film as spectacle.
But yeah, let me ask you this. Yeah. In just doing research and reading some of the books and looking at some of the films, nobody ever took a look at it. Nobody ever stepped back and said, this really is absurdist theater. And it was a pitch-perfect way to treat this. And why do you think no one else had spotted that possibility in it before, Brent?
Because I was I experienced the events of Chicago from my mother's womb. I was born in October of 68. So I approached these events totally fresh. They were foreign to me in every way, shape, or form. And when I went into this, Elvis, I had no idea that it was going to be a Yippie film, a Moab film, or what have you. I just went into – I sold the film before I had any idea what the subject really was about. I sold it. I knew that I knew what the film would be tonally. In my pitch of the film, it was like it's going to be – I was going to use contemporary music. I knew I was going to use animation at that point. But I really had no idea. I hadn't really done any research and I hadn't really settled on whether to do the Yippie point. I knew I couldn't do all 8 points of view. It would be too spread out.
But you do. I mean, you do touch on all 8 points of view, really.
Try to, but it's very – the film is ultimately, I think, rather Yippie-centric. You know, but anyways, I think that there was a something liberating about approaching – this story with sort of fresh eyes. And then, of course, I think the one revelation of our film is we're probably the first movie or book about Chicago that tried to synthesize the trial with the events of out in the streets that week, which to me seems so obvious. Like, why hasn't any – because, as you can see in the film, there's overt parallels. And you can do some wonderful contextualization. Like, for example, Bobby Seale, which to me has always been about racism, in the context of the movie, becomes a little more about freedom of speech as you're seeing Bobby being gagged while the protesters are, quote-unquote, being gagged. We intercut the climax of the trial with the final march to the Hilton. you know, the other, some of the other traumatizations are just strange. You know, they follow the chronology so closely that they end up with Bobby Seale getting Bobby Seale was remanded or severed from the case 6 weeks in. Trial went on for another 4.5 months. So most of the films about Chicago have Bobby, you know, having his scene at the end of Act One. And it's like, well, you can't go anywhere from there. There's like, you know, there's just nowhere to go.
It's The Treatment, I guess, is Brett Morgan. His new film as director is the documentary complete with animation and recreation of Chicago 10, a look at the events around the Chicago Convention, Democratic Convention of 1968. What fascinates me about using the outside world is that it really sets up how theatrical all this stuff is. I mean, we get a real sense of it. It's like a build almost. And it, what's weird is the courtroom scenes become kind of like real comedy, and the drama is actually taking place outside the courtroom.
Exactly, yeah. And I think the film needed that because the images outside the courtroom are so sobering and intense that the film needed some comedic relief. And fortunately, that was a big part of what the trial was. I think John Schultz in his book referred to that the trial was about who owned the laughter in the room in a way. The comedy in that courtroom was political. You can look at Abby and Jerry walking the courtroom dressed as in judges' robes as just, hey, look at these silly guys. But it's also a great piece of political theater. And they were basically taking authority away from the judge, and you know, it's kind of a beautiful thing to witness. So,
I mean, that sense of scale and that fact that Abbie Hoffman lived to fight. I mean, he may be the only revolutionary who was clubbed by Pete Townsend at a concert. He'd get on my stage and hit him in the head with a guitar. I mean, this is somebody who loved to cause as much abrasion as humanly possible. So he was born to do something like this.
Yeah. I think the thing with Abbie, though, that really separated him from most of the figures of his time and really make him stand out in the context of today's war is he was ridiculously funny. I mean, he had an amazing – he was, a disciple of Lenny Bruce. I mean,
you could tell in those conversations when he's having a WBAI, I mean, he really is just doing like a late-night monologue on the telephone.
He is. And you might have noticed, Elvis, in the film when we took some audio of Abbie, the real-life audio of Abbie that he actually was recorded in his studio, and then I put it on a stage like it was a Greenwich Village nightclub, and it's an homage to the movie Lenny, where it's black and white and it's with the front key, hard key. But I sort of saw him in that tradition, and you know, there's just – I found him totally inspiring, and I was also divorced of – and Abbie stayed a revolutionary to his last breath, and so it's not like he became a yuppie or whatever, but he never had quite – that was his moment, really. And, you know, when you talk to some people who were active at the time, you know, they may say, you know, Abbie was obnoxious, Abbie was this or that. And it's hard to separate who Abbie was in 68 when the world first met him to maybe, you know, he might have become a bit of a caricature in years past. I don't want to say caricature because that's totally unfair because Abbie was true to the end. But he just never had the potency or the platform is a better way of putting it. Than that he did in 68.
But he also never had that group of characters to interact with, too, and to bounce off of and to – I mean, that really was the perfect cast of characters for him. And he saw how ripe it was for – because by a few years later, after all those if all the elements were worked out, those guys weren't speaking to each other anymore. He completely alienated himself from them.
And that sort of is – I think why Judge Hoffman was such a perfect foil. I mean, Judge Hoffman and Mayor Daley, you just could not – they can cast them better to stand in contrast. They played right into Abby's hands. I mean, you know, Abbie keeps referring to the judge. You know, he keeps giving this joke about how he's going to deliver him some Jarrett Hall. And as young as and vibrant as Abbie was in the courtroom, the judge was, you know, stodgy and old and curmudgeon and just, you know – I mean, he was – I thought the guy was going to have a heart attack in the courtroom. I mean, it's amazing he actually survived the trial. And I think – actually, I think that was what – I think Abbie says it in the film that one of their – you know, what's their strategy? To give the judge a heart attack.
Yeah.
It's basically the only way they're going to get out of that case.
My guest is Brett Morgan. His new film as director is the great film Chicago 10. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Thank you.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW. My guest is director Brett Morgan. His new film is Chicago 10. You were talking about the enormous amount of film that you had to play with. When you saw that film and you realized it hadn't been used before, you saw that this is where the movie is, and that's what really helped you to shape it. Because you said before, as you set out, you weren't exactly sure which way to go with it.
Well, you know, when the methodology of this film was very similar to The Kid Stays in the Picture. It began with an evaluation of all the archival materials that would be available to us. So when I basically moved into Bob's house for 3 months right after we sold the film to Focus. And during that time, I looked through every piece of media that Bob had, then went back to the book trying to contextualize stories around archives, material that I would have to make the stories from. And one of the reasons I would select certain stories to go into the film versus others is some stories just couldn't properly be visualized without what I call like a holding shot, you know, of just some photograph that you've seen like 7 times already in the film because they have nothing else to show you. So with Chicago 10, it started with 2 years of media collection, where we would went around all over the planet collecting every piece of media we can get on the subject. And we culled 1,200 hours of film, 500 plus hours of audio, and 14,000 plus photographs. And so after evaluating all of that, I determined what material I could sculpt the film around. Then I went to the 23,000-page court transcript, went through it trying to find sequences and passages that would do double duty. On one level, they would help contextualize the archival footage. And on a second level, they would be representations of the courtroom. And my goal going in at some point after I got through the transcripts the first time was to basically have the events in the courtroom mirror the events in the streets of Chicago. So every scene in that courtroom really had to do sort of double duty in leading you through the events of the week in through the archival, and B, tell its own story about the courtroom.
I guess I was fascinated too by the music that you chose. It's all contemporary music. I mean, you end with Billy Preston, but you've got Eminem in there, and you've got the Beastie Boys. And how did you choose the pieces of music that you ended up using in the film?
I guess this is like music supervision literally through my iPod. I mean, that's really what it came down to, Elvis. And I didn't want to use the music from the 60s. I mean, we're not totally hardcore, but we have some Steppenwolf in there and the Billy Preston song. And there's some Sabbath, although it's 71 or 72. I just felt like the protest music of the 60s, you know, has been like the big ones have been appropriated by Madison Avenue and are being used to sell SUVs, and they sort of lose a little impact along the way. And it just, I think, would make the images feel a little moldy and dated. I mean, it's so cliched. You know, the music is just, you can't listen to it without feeling that it, you know, how sort of dated it is. And one of the things we want to do with this film is take this story that's 40 years old and give it sort of a, contemporary spin. But the music, it wasn't like we were trying hard. The music never felt incongruous to me. It was like when the first riot scene that we have in the film, we had most of it was shot in black and white. And there was these tanks rolling into Lincoln Park at night. It was really ominous. I mean, it was just basically light and shadow. And tanks and tear gas going all over the place, people screaming. And before we started editing the scene, I just turned to Stuart and I go, we got to use War Pigs on this. It's the perfect track. So it wasn't like – and I didn't look at the thing to see if War Pigs was 68, 69, 70, 71, 72. It just felt right. I mean, like, we have a scene where some protesters stormed the Logan statue, and I cut it to the Beastie Boys Sabotage. Like, Phil Oakes, I'm Not Marching Anymore, just wouldn't cut it there. It just didn't. I think after 68, music got darker and angrier. And, you know, we probably could have used music from 70, 71, 72 to help tell the story of 68. But I didn't think the music at that moment had totally reflected the energy of that week in Chicago. You know, the hippies were the punks of their days. And I think going back and listening, I mean, Jerry Rubin was an anarchist.
The hippies were yippies of the punk. Because I think the yippies, so they very much were about calling attention to themselves and a kind of self-awareness that the hippies didn't have.
That's true. But we, you know, I felt that I kept saying that if Abby and Jerry and some of these guys were around today, they wouldn't be listening to Buffalo Springfield and Phil Oakes. They'd be listening to Rage Against the Machine and Audioslave and that type of stuff. And so it just, you know, I'm glad you're into it. I mean, some people have, you know, it sort of throws them out of the film. Although it was funny, I was at a screening at USC last week and some kid raised his hand and said, you know, man, it felt like you were trying too hard with the music. And I said, you know, I got to be honest. I just like whipped out my iPod, man. I really didn't try that hard. So don't, you know, but I respect your point. And I said, I'm just curious, you know, how many people were alienated by the music? And this is a college crowd of about 400 to 500 kids.
Uh-huh.
Three people raised their hand. And I said, how many people thought the music helped them get into the story? And 400 people raised their hands. You know, you're not expecting it. And, you know, when we first premiered this film, we were the opening night film at Sundance. And it was a bizarre reaction. I felt like a lot of people – I mean, we got a standing ovation and it felt
but people
like –
But people didn't seem to know what to make of it.
They didn't know what to make of it. Because, like, there's no talking head interviews. There's no narration. It's animation. There's a contemporary score. There's no context to the year – limited context.
And you're not making anybody into a tragic victim, even with the most terrifying moment for most people, which is when Bobby Seale is brought back in bound and gagged. It's still not a big tragic moment. He's not made a victim in the way that he often is. He's not Christ on the cross in the way that he often is in so many of these kinds of films.
Yeah.
By the way, we should say the film we're talking about, Chicago 10. It's writer-director Brett Morgan is here. It's The Treatment. You can also hear the show at KCOW.com. Now, as you know, and we talked about this before we got started, there have been a number of announcements. I guess Aaron Sorkin has done a screenplay, I mean, and of this same incident, and Steven Spielberg's going to direct. What do you think has attracted them to the material?
Well, it came out of a right after Sundance last year, my agent set up some general meetings in town and as is a thing to do. And one of those screenings was with Walter Parks, Steven Spielberg's producer, and called Phil Raskin, my agent, and immediately and said, this is amazing. I got to remake this. And Walter got me on the phone and said, you know, I was completely blown away by this film. I would love to, you know, I'd love to remake it. I don't know if you have any interest or what you'd like to do. And I just spent 4 years making this film. I mean, it was, as Bob says in Kids Age of the Picture, giving birth to this film was more exhausting than Rosemary's Baby. and he, you know, said, yeah, would you be interested in remaking it? And I was like, there's no way I really can't live in this world for any longer. But, you know, to make a long story short, I believe they took the option from our financiers. I'm consulting with them on it. And so their movie, they're going to do their own movie for sure. It's, I don't know if it's officially going to be called Inspired by Chicago 10, Adapted by Chicago 10, or what have you. But that was where the Spielberg movie came about.
But it's fascinating because, I mean, that's such a great way to set it. I mean, it really lends itself to almost to Spielberg's kind of purview. I mean, moving between two different worlds and going from the sort of containment to taking outside. And the way you shot, the way you staged a lot of this stuff, I don't know if I can say shot, but the way that it was literally animated, it lends itself to a real largeness of scale that I think people also weren't used to seeing in documentaries. And that's what threw them off. I mean, used to seeing stuff, the historical stuff that you can sort of look at and detach from. And what you want to make this movie about was the emotional connection you want people to have, right?
Absolutely. No, it's been a really interesting ride, man. I think that there's really nothing I would change about the film going back after hearing the criticism and whatnot that were lobbied at us because, you know, the movie. You know, what really blows my mind. Okay, so this movie had a very – I fought another massive fight with the financiers was about context, how much context to put in about 1968. My producing partner is Graydon Carter. There's a methodology to how one approaches a magazine article about the subject. You have a sort of a really interesting opening paragraph or two, and then you go back and you sort of lay down the context to those scenes, and then you march forward. It's, you know, pretty standard. For very obvious reasons, everyone kept telling me, you have to make this more about 1968. You have to make this more about 1968. You have to throw in all this context. And I would get all these emails about all the stuff to put in. And I kept thinking, well, if you know all that and your peers know all that, then what the hell do I have to put in the film for? Like, why can't you just bring it to the film? And if you didn't know any of that stuff, then you ain't going to miss anything. So in my mind, it was kind of like, you know, when I was 14, I moved to England to study Shakespeare. And you don't need to really know the historical context to the plays that Shakespeare's where he's setting his plays to understand the drama of those plays. They transcend whatever, you know, setting they have. And I thought that in a way I was going this would work kind of in that context, that this was a sort of epic story that's about Chicago. Maybe it's also about Tiananmen Square. Maybe it's about Seattle. Maybe it's about Genoa. Maybe it's about all these things. It's a universal story. And the more I put it, more context, meaning facts and date and leaders, history lessons that I put into it, the less you can experience it.
You don't want people to think about it. You want people to feel it.
To feel it, right. And so what's so interesting, I was just reading Jay Hoberman's review, which is a really fascinating review about the film. I mean, I think it took him longer to write it than it took me to make the film, and it took me 4 years to make the film. And I definitely had to get a dictionary at a couple points. I'll totally admit it. But he seemed to really be into the film. And then he gets to this part where he says, but Morgan needed to put in this other context. And then he lists for, you know, three or four paragraphs all the stuff that should go in the film. And I'm thinking to myself, wouldn't I have bored you, Mr. Jay Hoberman, if I had put in, recycled all of this information that you already know? Like, wouldn't that be a little boring for you? Wouldn't you rather see footage that, as smart as you are and as schooled as you are on the subject, I know for a fact you have not seen 85 to 90% of the footage in this film because they're outtakes. And unless you were doing a documentary on the subject, you would have no access to them. So, I just don't understand. You know, to me, I understand why people can have a problem with it. But it's funny because, you know, it's like the people who have a problem are the ones schooled in the history. And I think they're afraid of this. They're afraid that their history will be forgotten and preserved. The boomers are, I don't want to say it with disdain, but that generation of the 60s is the most well-documented generation that's ever walked this planet. They have the best archives too, man. It's all 16mm. The rest of us are just messed up for life. But you know, they're so well documented and preserved. And I think there's a fear that I've sensed that if one presents this information without the signifiers of that period, that somehow history will take my version of the story and these important sort of contextualizing signposts will be lost. And there's also a battle or a struggle, I think, which will ensue in the next 10 years over who owns the history. And, I feel like nobody owns the history, guys. You know, lighten up a little bit. You know, it's like, I said to Todd Gitlin at Sundance, I was like, no one, your books aren't going anywhere, Todd. If anyone wants to know the definitive history of the 60s, they could read your book, The 60s, man, because you wrote it. You own it.
Those complaints and digressions are courtesy of my guest, director Brett Morgan. His new film is Chicago 10. Brett, it's always good to see you. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks, Ellis.
Our technical director at KCRW in Santa Monica is J.C. Swadek, with assistance from Noriko Okabe at Carnegie Recording Studios. Bob Carlson is the editor. Gemma Dempsey produces the program. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You're on trial. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.